Support for Aspen Public Radio comes from Balcom & Green PC, a full-service law firm with offices in Glenwood Springs, Aspen, and Basalt, providing advice and solutions for their clients' legal needs throughout Western Colorado for more than 60 years. Learn more at balcomgreen.com.
Welcome to Valley Roundup. I'm Carolyn Zachariasen. The news that the Bureau of Land Management plans to cancel 25 oil and gas leases on the Thompson Divide has all sides reacting. And the public relations effort is getting ramped up around a hotel development at the base of Aspen Mountain.
They have media consultants dedicated to each individual paper.
Meanwhile, an Aspen man is suing a local dentist for allegedly pulling the wrong tooth. And a local reporter reflects on his coverage over the past 2 years before he goes into the public sector. He says he can identify with the story he did this week on the stresses of living and working in the valley.
These folks have to travel 2.5 hours a day just to get to work, and they're working in a place they can't really afford to hang out in or have fun in.
A survey of students in the valley shows that Latinos are less optimistic than their Anglo counterparts.
It's almost like these parallel lives that Anglos and Latinos live in the valley.
And a bank robber was brazen enough to walk right onto Grand Avenue on a busy afternoon, eluding police. Joining me this week on Valley Roundup are Randy Essex, editor of the Glenwood Post-Independent, Colin Suzik, reporter for the Aspen Daily News, and Curtis Wackerly, editor of the Aspen Daily News. Thank you for coming in the studio.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Colin, so I haven't had you on the show before, but now this is your last opportunity before you go into the world of public relations for the government. What are you going to be doing?
The position is it's a communications coordinator. So kind of helping out both, you know, internally throughout the organization, getting people in touch with who need to be, and then also getting disseminating information out to the public if there's, say a fire in the area or something like that.
When did you start working at the Daily News? I can't remember when I
It was actually
made
August
you an offer.
2 years ago.
Oh, wow.
2014, right?
Yeah, 2014.
Yeah. Well, we're going to be sad to see you go. You've been doing some good stories, including the coverage of the Thompson Divide and oil and gas leases there, and you had a byline last week on the BLM decision. So why did the BLM only decide on canceling 25 of the 65? Leases.
I would say it was probably, there was obviously a lot of pressure coming from industry. And while the industry didn't necessarily take part in the public eye, as far as that process, they did behind the scenes. They, you know, they worked with a lot of lawyers. They got a lot of information in. And while overwhelmingly of the, I believe it was almost 60,000 comments came in, and almost overwhelmingly they were in favor of canceling all the leases. You know, industry has a lot of weight when it comes to this type of thing.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's become very political and symbolic. I mean, in a rational world, perhaps this would be viewed as a worthy compromise. You know, you take the leases in kind of the wildest, most roadless, mountainous, pretty area, take those off the table, leave the ones that are in kind of the surrounding zones that are already closer to some existing development, and everyone can just kind of call it a day. But this has become a political fight. You know, you have the member of Congress representing the Western Slope taking the side of the oil and gas company. Oil and gas company, you know, wrapping themselves in the Constitution, saying this is a property rights issue. And you have Roaring Fork Valley locals of all stripes saying, no, this is about our fundamental values and about making sure we have an environment that is sustainable. So it's a very, it's a very emotional debate.
And I also think that a lot of this is going to end up playing out in the whole public lands being, handed over to the states debate that's going on. And during the meeting in Washington, D.C., you saw them asking, the committee members kept asking the oil and gas representatives, does this type of thing happen in state-owned lands? Is it easier to get in and drill in state-owned lands? And they said, absolutely. So I think it's going to be part of that larger discussion as, things go by. And I believe the other night, Rachel Richards at the joint meeting between Pitkin County and the city of Aspen talked about NACO, there was a vote there because she brought it up to have support for public land turnover taken off of their agenda, and it was voted down. I believe she said it was 8-20. So that's, counties in this state are favoring this.
Is the swap still on the table? This proposed swap of leases for out in the North Fork Valley, right?
It is Tipton's? North Fork. Tipton brought that up, and it was kind of, I almost viewed it as a Hail Mary. It was almost verbatim taken from a proposal written by SG Interests. And he kind of just put it out there, and when people called them on that and said, hey, this was basically written by industry, he said, well, this is just a first step. But in saying that it was just a first step, that kind of, he was almost looking to preclude all the work that had already happened throughout the last almost decade on stuff like this. And I believe, obviously the session ended and nothing really moved on with it or anything, but I'm sure it's coming back.
I noticed in both papers there was guest commentary by the developers of the Gorsuch House. In the Aspen Times, it was Jim DeFrancia who wrote a column.
Right.
And Jeff Gorsuch wrote a column in your paper.
Right. These guys are very PR'd up. They have media consultants for days. I think they have media consultants dedicated to each individual paper.
Yeah, right? Yes, I know. I mean, I had a site visit up there not that long ago. I mean, they're going to need to turn it on because my prediction is it's going to go to a public vote.
That's certainly very likely. I mean, you have a rezoning tied up in all this, which is an easy thing to put on the ballot. All you need is 600 signatures. Jeff Gorsuch's column in our paper in the Daily News was kind of a retelling of his family story and about how his parents first came to Aspen. His grandparents first came to Aspen in the 40s with his father as a young lad to watch ski racing on Slalom Hill way back in the day before there was even a chairlift here. And, they've grown and progressed and opened a ski shop in Aspen in the 70s. And in telling of this kind of family legend, it would come back to this refrain of, we need vitality at the base of Lift 1A. And I found the column lacking in that it didn't really address any of sort of the substantive criticisms of the land use application in that it's too big.
Right.
I mean, it spoke to it in maybe a couple lines here and there, but the piece clearly was not intended to be a point-by-point response to the substantive criticisms of the land use application. And, they'll say, well, that's what the public hearings are for in P&Z, and we're doing that. We're going through the formal process that way. And, fair enough. Maybe people don't want to read about FAR calculations, and they'd rather, it's probably a better story to tell to talk about how your dad grew up ski racing, and that's why you're wanting to develop this land.
Right. Not that you're trying to rezone it and go way
right, and why our rezoning proposal is okay compared to what the city is saying, and that gets into the weeds.
Right.
But that is really where that's where a lot of this debate is right now.
Well, that's where it's gonna stay. I mean, they go back to P&Z on August 16th, I believe.
That's correct.
They have to make some significant changes. It sounds like from what P&Z asked them to do.
There have been calls from the P&Z and from the city's planning staff for changes to the mass and scale, to the footprint, to the way the lift is accessed. I know there's a lot of people out there who are concerned about this hotel basically running right up to the toe of the Norway ski run, and you're not going to be able to return ski to the lift without taking off your skis if you're descending the left side of the run. There's an interesting story I thought. He's not here to talk about it, but Scott Condon in the Aspen Times wrote a piece where he tried to get the Ski Co., the Aspen Skiing Company, to answer a question that has been very prevalent here, which is, Ski Co., this is your land, and you seem to be taking a very hands-off approach to this development proposal. This is Ski Company-owned land. It's under contract to the Gorsuch developers, and they are running the show here as far as what the proposal is. And if you ask Ski Co. about it, they basically say, well, that's the developer's deal, and we're just trying to work, we're working around what they're proposing.
Right. They're saying we're under contract
right.
with the land, so we can't say much about
well,
it
Well, and it just raises the question, well, if this is your land, why don't you, the ski company, design a land use plan that you feel like is in your best interest.
And, right, like they did with the Little Nell on the other side.
Right. And, you know, I found it very interesting that that Scott was denied an interview with, you know, with David Perry or whoever the executive would be that really has the final say on these decisions, and instead got a statement that basically said, well, you know, the recession happened and we had a plan back in 2009 that the city shut down, so that kind of took the wind out of our sails and had us decide to look at offloading this, making it someone else's problem.
Well, and they're kind of slamming their head against the wall in snowmass with development anyway.
Right.
So
Idaho, apparently, you know, it's going great in Idaho. Right. They're building the Limelight, you know.
Yeah. Well, you got to go somewhere where they're desperate. And while the Lift 1A side looks desperate, we're not that desperate, apparently. You know, but even, let's say that they come in with no variances at all to the code.
Which would be impossible because it's zoned for cow pasture right now.
Okay. So they have to rezone it. But that wouldn't.
It's zoned for a single family home, a ski lift, and open space, basically.
Right. Zoning is not one of the triggers for Ref 1, is it?
No, it's not an automatic trigger for Referendum 1. Referendum 1 is only triggered when you have variances related to housing, mass scale, parking. This one's a little tricky. It doesn't quite fit Referendum 1, but whenever the city council passes an ordinance to rezone something, that is one of those categories of actions where any citizen can just grab a petition, get a number of signatures, and then the city council either has to walk back its decision or set it for a vote. So
right.
It doesn't really get, you know, it's got at least one more, if not a few more hearings with the P&Z, and then it has to go kind of through the same thing all over again at city council.
On a lighter note, your coverage of this tooth trial is interesting and kind of entertaining. Small claims court coverage, that's classic Daily News style. So there's a guy in town who's in front of city council a lot making public comment, Neil Siegel. And yeah. He got the wrong tooth pulled, apparently.
He claims the dentist pulled the wrong tooth. The dentist's defense is that you gave me permission to pull this tooth. It needed to be pulled. You know, basically that he had a couple of problems going on. And that he was, you know what, there's been a number of stories about this. One of which the plaintiff, confirmed that he signed a form saying, sure, you can take out this tooth number 18. But he said, oh, I had no idea what that meant. I wasn't sure what tooth I was giving him permission to pull.
So it's kind of like guilt by association. It was the tooth next to it, so it had to go as well.
Well, the dentist is claiming that both teeth were bad, that the tooth he pulled needed to be extracted.
What was the conversation about covering this trial?
Well, I think it's such a unique legal claim, and I mean that just gets right to your gut, like, oh God.
Yeah, anyone can relate with it. Everybody's had to go on and had some type of procedure like that done. So they go, ooh, what if that happened to me?
Right, yeah. Can you imagine if there actually was some sort of mistake made and the wrong tooth got pulled? I mean, who can't relate to that?
Yeah, that's for sure. Colin, what are some of your favorite stories that you've written and covered since you've been at the Daily News?
You know, I've really enjoyed, I guess a lot of the, you know, obviously the outdoors, I really liked covering open space and trails and, you know, just the amount of resources that go into that are just, it's mind-boggling, you know, but it's such a neat thing to really kind of keep that local, you know, that historic character here in the valley. And, you know, otherwise, what would this place look like? I mean, development, holy cow.
Right.
I mean, we think we have traffic bad now. What would it be? So that's been a lot of fun. I've greatly enjoyed, actually, it sounds funny to everybody, but the RAFTA meetings have been really entertaining, and it was really sad hearing about the passing of Frank Breslin this week, the former Newcastle mayor and such. He was a really, really affable, funny guy, and I'm sure he'll be missed. But, you know, you bring that many personalities and let's say, egos together in one room, you get some pretty funny commentary.
I would also highlight Colin's coverage of the county commissioner's trials and tribulations dealing with the marijuana industry. There's been lots of great stories about that over the course of the last 2 years. I mean, You know, you get these guys who think they've hit the jackpot because they're gonna do something in the pot industry, and then they run into the county commissioners who are, you know, definitely skeptical of a lot of this stuff, and it makes for some pretty dramatic hearings.
Yeah, didn't I read in one of your stories that George Nimmin is like, well, if we could just make like Brussels sprouts edibles,
right? Exactly. Right. The war on edibles. It's like the war on Christmas.
They really want to nip the whole edibles you know, thing in the bud.
You are listening to Valley Roundup, a look at the week's news with writers and editors in the Valley. I'm Carolyn Zachariasen. Joining me this week are Colin Suzik, reporter for the Aspen Daily News, Curtis Wackerly, editor of the Aspen Daily News, and later in the show, Randy Essex, editor of the Glenwood Post-Independent.
This week, I wrote a story about the Valley Health Alliance and their findings from 2015. And I thought it was really interesting when you talk about the stresses and such that are brought to this valley. And executive director of the VHA, Kathleen Killian, had said she had made a comment about these folks have to travel, you know, 2.5 hours a day just to get to work. And they're working in a place they can't really afford to hang out in or have fun in. And I myself have been doing that for the last 2 years, and I can say just from my own personal outlook on it, the depression does hit you. It is very, very painful, especially in the wintertime when you're getting up and it's dark out, and then you're coming home and it's dark out, and it's definitely a real thing. That commute is tough on people.
You've been going from Glenwood up to Aspen every day.
Yeah.
For 2 years.
On the bus, too.
On the bus. And the BRT is actually a great help. I mean, it was when you have to take a local bus in the off season, you see some grouchy people. So nobody likes to stay. You know, you hit a stop and you kind of punch the chair next to you like, damn it, why are we stopping here? Wingo Junction, where is this? You know, and stuff. And, you know, it was interesting to write about that topic and the effects that it has, and then also be living through it as well.
Yeah.
And it's definitely very real.
Do they have any solutions to that? Is there any way to combat it?
I thought it was, and this doesn't obviously cover everybody, but I thought it was interesting in a joint meeting, city and county, the other day, John Peacock had said, we're probably coming into the last generation that is going to face, or are going to be looking at brick and mortar offices, and the way of the future is going to be a tablet, a login, and strong broadband. That would help one sector to be able to work from home. So there's some benefits there. It doesn't obviously help service industry or construction, things like that. But, you know, it's a start.
It's just this high-flying economy we've built here that requires people to commute. More jobs than there is housing in the city of Aspen.
Well, I think the one solution right off the bat is, I was talking to Brent about it in the show last week, Brent Gardner-Smith. I mean, he's just lazy. That's why he drives. That's what he said. I'm just too lazy.
What's
to get on a bus? He's like,
because he has to go to the park and ride and park.
Yeah,
and
he doesn't. So anybody who doesn't need to drive needs to get off the road. Yeah. So the people who do need to drive are not sitting in that traffic as much.
Oh, absolutely.
I wish Colin the best, and I think you know, you're certainly not going to be too sad to be missing that commute anymore, and we can all understand that. So
yeah. Yeah. No, it was like a lot of fun. You know, I'll definitely miss the stories and the opportunities to, you know, find these things that you find that gem and you see it and you go, oh my gosh, this people are going to love this. And it's so exciting. You can't wait to write it.
Well, good luck to you.
Thank you.
And thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having us, Carolyn.
Thanks.
Now joining me by phone is Randy Essex, editor of the Glenwood Post-Independent. I did enjoy your piece on the Latino.
Well, it's a hope gap. The Gallup survey that's done around the country and is commissioned here by the Aspen Community Foundation for the Aspen to Parachute, I think it's Cradle to Career Initiative, looked at basically a lot about students' attitudes, and how optimistic or hopeful a student is has been shown to be a real predictor of how they will succeed as adults. And what jumped out at me in this, I mean, if you were to look at the breakdown, the kids in Aspen, 61% of the kids in the Aspen schools are optimistic. Can you imagine? What really jumped out at me was that our Latino students pretty uniformly are not only less optimistic than their white peers, but less optimistic than Latino kids nationally. So we set out to explore that. I had an intern this summer who is a Latina Glenwood Springs High School graduate, so it was something that was fairly close to her heart. And she talked to kids and she talked to educators who emphasized the need for mentors, which I think is the initiative that's going to come out of this, is the school district's really trying to expand getting adults involved up close with kids so that they can see the possibilities for themselves.
They see adults of their ethnicity, and they're not necessarily college graduates, and they're working service jobs, or, you know, they don't know what's possible beyond that.
Yeah, there was a really, I thought, telling quote about how kids will say they want to be nurses or teachers because those are the Latino role models who they see.
Right.
And, you know, maybe not, I mean, we are short on Latino elected officials and civic leaders, and there are many small business people, but I don't know if a kid in high school necessarily aspires to run their own insurance agency or their own auto shop or something like that. I think that it points to a real effort to break through. It's almost like these parallel lives that Anglos and Latinos live in the Valley, and I really compliment the effort. Our story was not meant to say, oh gosh, look at this terrible thing, we're doomed. It was meant to be a look at the constructive effort to identify and do something about it.
I also found it interesting that the program manager for the initiative, Gretchen, she was quoted, or paraphrased anyway, about that this index could be a better predictor of college success than a GPA or any of the SAT scores.
And I think intuitively that makes sense, that your attitude and your optimism fuel your belief that you can accomplish something. So if you run into a roadblock when you're away from home at college, that sort of core outlook on life is what's going to get you through.
When was this poll taken?
It was last school year.
Okay.
And it's been administered, I think, each of the last at least 3 years. I'd have to dig into it. It may be for the last 5 years. And again, the Community Foundation, I believe, is going to continue it so they can see if they're affecting change.
Right. And so this poll, like RE2, some of those schools are, the majority is Hispanic, right? And Anglo is the minority.
When you come down Valley from Aspen, the Basalt schools are at least half Hispanic. Glenwood Springs schools are about half Hispanic. Carbondale, I think, is majority Hispanic. And then RE2 is certainly at least half. And we didn't mention this in the story, but I thought it was pretty interesting that Yampa Mountain, which is an alternative school where kids do get a lot of support, they get some mentoring, they get individual attention. Those kids were really, after Aspen, those were the second most optimistic group of kids.
Did anybody speak to that, even though it didn't make it into the story?
It might be a separate story for us, Carolyn. You know, Yampa Mountain is in the running for this giant super school grant that's being funded by Steve Jobs' widow.
Okay.
It has made the cut of about the last 50 schools out of, I believe, 750 applicants for a $10 million grant over 5 years. It will be September before the ultimate winners are announced. But either way, I think that we should look at Yampa Mountain, and that's where these findings provide a bit of context.
That's really interesting about Yampa. I look forward to reading about that. So you had some crime last week.
So Friday at 5:30, and I didn't know banks were still open at 5:30.
Me either.
A guy in big sunglasses, almost like a traditional bandit mask, or a, you know, what you see people on the Rio Grande Trail wearing over their face to keep bugs out of their mouth, and a straw hat, walked into the Vector Bank at 8th and Grand, the busiest intersection in Glenwood Springs, at one of the very busiest times of the week. I mean, people are getting off work, the tourists are here, they're walking around looking for places to eat or just go in and browse. This guy walks in, intimates that he has a gun, and of course the tellers do what they're supposed to do and give him money, and he takes off south down Grand Avenue. And here we are almost a week later, there haven't been any arrests. We get a bank robbery, I guess, every 2 years or so in Glenwood Springs.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting to me that somebody could do something so brazenly. And maybe it was the fact that it was crowded, you know, he was just able to blend in and get away. I thought that when we posted this story that there would be people who said, oh my God, I saw him. And there was none of that. I don't know that there's any great insight to be gained from that, but I was really, really shocked.
He probably played it pretty smart in that he could just take off this hat, that mask, and just blend right into the masses.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of times, banks that are near interstates are vulnerable, but usually it's a question of driving in and driving out, and then, you know, maybe you hit a bank two counties away or two states away or something like that. The guy who robbed an Alpine Bank in West Glenwood that was near an interstate exit 2 years ago, he, as it turned out, was suspected in robberies in Florida and Texas.
I covered a bank robbery in Santa Monica, California, where the suspects hailed a cab to get away.
Goodness.
I know. And also there was big news on Friday with the Thompson Divide. We knew that was coming. At least we got a heads up the day before that there was going to be some sort of big decision by the Bureau of Land Management, which was that they are planning on canceling 25 leases. Can you put some context in for our listeners on what that really means? Like, how much does that protect Thompson Divide?
If it stands, it protects Thompson Divide for 20 years because it would go hand-in-hand with the Forest Service's decision on Thompson Divide not to issue new leases during the 20 years of its next management plan. And it is really just a huge victory for the Thompson Divide Coalition, the ranchers, the environmentalists. Of course, the oil and gas industry would say the rich Aspenite environmentalists. I was at Mountain Fair on Saturday, and Zane Kessler, head of the Thompson Divide Coalition, got up on stage between acts and thanked Carbondale for all of its support. It was kind of the epicenter of the Thompson Divide movement. You know, it's not the final word. There's a really good chance that the industry will sue.
What else are you working on? What can we expect to see in the pages of the
Post?
Well,
on Monday we're going to have a very special guest columnist. The words of Donald Trump will appear on the Post-Independent Opinion page. Don't miss it.
That was Randy Essex, editor of the Glenwood Post-Independent. Thanks to him, as well as Curtis Wackerly, editor of the Aspen Daily News, and Colin Susick, reporter for the Aspen Daily News. I'm Carolyn Sakariasen, and you've been listening to Valley Roundup. You can get a rundown of links and more information on the stories covered on this show on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. Valley Roundup is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.